Welcome to Education Suspended, a podcast focused on exploring, engaging, and dialoguing with those in education who are passionate about changing the status quo and evolving the archaic system we have inherited.
Hey everyone, welcome to Education Suspended. Jessica Pfeiffer here. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate your patience. I will just say the last 2 months have been a little challenging, and I've got some changes at a family systems level that I'm just adjusting to. And part of that has been figuring out how to navigate and balance things that I am now responsible for, which is totally fine, and things that I love doing and want to sustain, such as this podcast. And so it's involved Steve and I having some conversations about how do we keep this going? How do we make this something that lasts, because we both love it so much, and we know that you all love this podcast, and we want to continue to provide this support and this resource for everyone that listens. And at the same time, we need to be able to practice what we preach, essentially, which is we've got to be flexible. I've got to be able to allow myself some grace and some space to shift, you know, our dose and our space. So part of that was we have taken a break for a while of recording our reflective dissociation sessions, which we really do love doing, but that was one that we said, okay, let's hit pause on that to free up some time. And then the next thing that we are doing is, just for right now, until I can kind of get my feet back under me, we're going to be pivoting to releasing an episode once every 3 weeks for the rest of this season versus once every 2 weeks. And hoping that helps keep my head above water. But again, thank you for your patience. There will be times that I just can't get that 3-week deadline there, and I apologize. But the one thing that will not change, and I can guarantee that, are the amazing interviews and the content and the lessons to be learned and the motivation for us to keep going and keep changing the system. So that being said, let's go ahead and talk about our interview in this episode, which is with Mr. Rodney Robinson. This was such a fun interview. And no big deal, but Rodney was actually the 2019 National Teacher of the Year. It was really cool that we were able to sit down with him, and that he was gracious enough to give us his time. Obviously, to be the National Teacher of the Year, you have to have done a lot of stuff, but he really has. And I think one of the things that we really focus on in our conversation today is just equity versus equality. What's the difference in those? How do we begin to transform this system and ensure that we're doing it in a way that provides representation, that provides a space for us to learn from our teachers, to learn from our students? And really, at the end of the day, when this interview was done, I was just so fired up. Rodney is a really good motivational speaker. He's got great stories. And so, Rodney, to you, thank you for your time. And to you listeners, this is a little nugget of gold. So sit back and enjoy Education Suspended with Rodney Robinson.
Good day at school. Stay kind and curious.
Hey, you know.
We did it.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
How are you?
Oh, tired, but I'm good.
I imagine you're tired. You do a lot of great things in your life.
Thank you.
You know, when we are getting ready to do this podcast, I was listening to other podcasts out there, which is how I heard about you. So I was listening to a podcast, Teaching to Thrive. I don't know if you remember that podcast. Dr. Bettina Love, Abolitionist Teaching.
Yeah.
I'm slightly obsessed with her. We'll say slightly, because this is a public podcast. And you were a guest in 2020, and I thought your interview was just so genuine and so engaging. And I was like, that's someone that I would love to talk to. And just your history as a teacher, I found motivating. So here you are. So this is it's an honor to have you. We do start all of our podcasts the same. We're going to have you introduce yourselves to our listeners. We're going to have you talk about what you do.
Okay.
And, you know, a little bit of how you got there. And then our favorite part is reflecting and sharing on your own experience as a student and the connections to the now. How does that story influence you today? We'll just start with that. Do you have any questions about those first components?
Nah, let's roll.
All right, the ball's all yours. Take it away and we'll just see where we go.
All right. Hello, everybody. My name is Rodney Robinson. I am a lifelong educator. I've been officially licensed in the education business for 24 years now, started in 2000. I am the 2019 National Teacher of the Year. I currently work in Richmond Public Schools in the talent office as a senior advisor and director of Teacher Leader Pathways. For those who don't know what that is, it's sort of like a gumbo job where it's everything from recruitment to developing to building up teachers to helping teachers grow to whatever they want to be in the profession. It's just a little bit of everything, but it's really important job. It's really important for us, especially in the midst of this teaching shortage, to identify those who want to stay, who want to help, and to support them, and also identify those people who want to get in the profession and create programs that support them and build them up so that they can become great classroom teachers one day. It's really a labor of love. You know, in 2020, I actually left the classroom to go to central office, and I didn't want to be one of those stuck at a desk reading data reports kind of central office person. That's not me. You know, my vibe is working with people. And so it started with just recruiting teachers. And then from recruiting teachers, I went about, okay, getting to know the other staff and people in the building and just building relationships, as we all know is the key to any educational setting, but building those relationships and growing and nurturing current teachers and building and helping those who want to become teachers. And so it's not the classroom. I'll be honest, I miss the classroom every single day. I love those kids. I love the energy from those kids, but it's just the next best thing because I'm working with adults. And so I'm getting that energy and that excitement from adults who want to be in the classroom. I grew up in King William County, Virginia. King William County, Virginia is one of those small rural southern counties. It's interesting. I tell people growing up, I had a very good academic education, but I didn't get a great cultural education. So I never fully believed in myself. I never was really pushed to be the best I could be. I was just one of those kids that got by off of natural ability. You know, I have to tell, you know, I tell these kids, my kids all the time, I put the same effort forth in every class. It all depended on who that teacher was, whether that effort was an A or whether that effort was a C. But it was, you're going to get the same effort out of me. But I did have a few Black teachers who didn't let me get by. They pushed me to be my best. So starting in from third and fourth grade with Ms. Hall and Ms. Broadus. You know, it's funny because everybody knows the survey, you know, the study that says kids who get one Black teacher in elementary school are 39% less likely to drop out, 19% more likely to go to college. And when I look back on my education, I think of the Black students that had Ms. Hall and Ms. Broadus. The vast majority of us graduated. A lot of us had gone on to college. And so when I saw that study, that was just validation of my life experience. You know, having Ms. Hall and Ms. Broadus, and it was just a unique thing because they didn't let me put forth that same effort. You know, I was an elementary kid where I would just do the work so I could go play. But with them, it's like, no, this work isn't good enough. I need you to do better, you know, before you can go play. And so it was that. And plus with them, I knew third, fourth grade or specific grades, I remember my mom going on every field trip, being in the PTA. And so that, once again, that USDOE study that says when Black kids have Black teachers, parents are more involved. So I remember my mom and dad being at the school involved in more events because they were part of the community. And so it was just a really good experience. And then after them, the only Black teacher I had was Mr. Sorrell, my band teacher. From fifth grade all the way through 12th grade. Of course, it's rural town, so small school. So it was the middle and high school band director. And I took band every year, you know, and it wasn't just because I was a triple threat, of course, baritone, trombone, and tuba. But it was just Mr. Sorrell. you know, hanging around Mr. Sorrell, you know, seeing a Black man in education who set high expectations, who always lectured me, always was looking out for me, that person that pulled me to the side and tell me when I was messing up, but also the person that would give me that encouragement I needed when I was doing the right thing. And he was just so instrumental in helping me survive academia. You know, one of those things they don't talk about, when you're one of the few Black kids on the honors track, it's a very lonely and confusing time in education. You know, I would have teachers that would say, hey, you're different from the other kids. You're better than the other kids. And I'm like, you mean my brothers, my friends? How am I different and better than them? And so it created a lot of confusion growing up. And Mr. Sorrell helped me navigate those worlds and understanding that, hey, you know, we have high expectations. You're not better than them. You're just in a different program. You perform at a higher level of their expectations. But always understand you're not better than anybody. You just perform better on certain things. And so he kept me grounded and helped me when I was having those issues of dealing with teachers who never understood me, never got me. And he took me places. I mean, we went to Canada, South Carolina, Florida, all these different places that I never would have been exposed to had I not been with Mr. Sorrell. I also was the manager of the softball team, which he coached. You know, and I tell people, I was like, yeah, I'm just trying to be around the girls. But the reality was, I just, more time I got to hang out with Mr. Sorrell and go places and do things. Tell people all the time, I had my father in my life, my brothers, my uncles, but none of them had a college education. Mr. Sorrell was one of the few people in my life who had a college education and let me know that college is something aspirational for me. And he pushed me to go to college. And so I don't know where I would be, honestly. Without Mr. Sorrell, I could have been one of those kids that was written off, one of those kids that had been kicked out of school, you know, just so many different situations that he helped guide me through. When I see other kids in the school that didn't have that guidance are now in not as fortunate situations in life because of that.
I think it's so easy to, and we talk about this quite a bit, but I think it's just so easy to minimize the true impact of representation on the kids. And so those statistics were so, I'm so glad that you shared those. And I love how you said, right, like you had the good education, but that cultural piece was missing. And that is vitally important. If you can't connect with that, it's hard.
And even if you look, like growing up in, when I grew up in Kingland County, it was about, I guess it was about 60-40 white to Black in the county. But now when you go out there, is closer to about 80-20 white to Black. And the reason is so many people like myself, all the Black people who went off to college, we never went back. Mm-hmm. We never went back. We moved on with our lives. We didn't go back because we just knew we didn't have, our opportunities were limited out there and that they would be limited in that sort of place because it didn't have cultural environment to support the things we're trying to do. And so now when I go to that school or I go to things and I see it's like, where are the Black people in that room? Oh, it's me. I left. You know, all my classmates that went to college, they left and they didn't move back. Whereas the kids who stayed out there are the kids that never moved to college because they didn't have that cultural education. So it's really important to understand, no matter how much academic support you give someone, if they don't believe in themselves culturally and know what they can do and are shown the things, the impossibilities that exist for someone from their culture, kids will never fulfill what they can truly be in life.
I hope I say this right. I think to some degree it perpetuates the cycle that you just talked about, right? This underlying message of your culture is not enough here. So there's always this like this undertone of like, oh, you can get out of here. You too can. It's like, well, what's wrong with the here?
Yeah. Yeah. I go out there. My mom's still out there. My brothers and sisters, everyone's still out there. I love the area. It's just not for me anymore I know that exists. And there's no coincidence, I'll say this also, that the majority of Black kids who grew up in Kingland County, most of us ran straight to HBCUs because we missed that cultural relevance, you know, that we had, or we went to a school like VCU, which has one of the most diverse institutions in the state of Virginia, even though it's still a PWI. Everyone that left was searching for culture. You know, and it wasn't just the Black kids. We had a lot of Native American kids, a lot of the LGBTQ population. We just left because we just knew there was more out there. And it's not just the King William thing. It's a phenomenon in a lot of rural Virginia right now. That's why people say, how Virginia become a red to purple blue state so quickly? And it's because so many people in the rural areas are leaving and coming to the urban areas because they're seeking validation for who they are and what they want to be in life.
Well, I didn't want to get past this discussion because you brought up your mom a couple times. And I, listening to you, Rodney, you said she might have been your best teacher.
Oh, yeah, easily.
I think led you to this real emphasis on equity that I caught as a main stream of thought and purpose for you. But I thought it would be fun for our listeners to hear a little story about your mom and equity. And it was something about going to the club. So
yeah.
I thought maybe that would be something we should, because it has bigger implications.
Yeah. You know, I often talk about growing up in rural Virginia. One thing about growing up in those rural areas, there was nothing to do. You know, growing up as a kid, we didn't even have cable TV out there in the 90s. You know, we were good day. We could turn the antenna and pick up a DC station. That was entertainment for us. No internet. But I just remember there was this one club, like a town over, that you could go to when you turned 15. And when I turned 15, I was ready to go with my brothers and my mom wouldn't let me go. You know, and I couldn't understand why she wouldn't let me go. So I snuck out, went to the club one night, you know, the whole teenage rebellion thing. I'm going to sneak out while mom's out of town. But when I went, it was just a bad experience, totally bad experience. And I remember having a conversation with my mother about that experience. And I couldn't understand why she wouldn't allow me to go. And she said, a good parent knows their children and what they need and don't need and what they're ready and not ready for. When your brothers and sisters were 15, they could handle that environment. When you were 15, you need to grow and mature some more before you went. That's why you got punched in the eye, you know? And so that was really just one of those lessons that I took in my classroom that says, look, as a teacher, I know all my kids come to me on different levels. And so it's my job as an educator to make sure that every kid in that room gets what they need. Some kids need a lot, some kids need very little. But it's my job as the teacher of that classroom to make sure every kid has what they need. And then also, I had a sister with cerebral palsy growing up, you know? And so my mother would tell us all the time, she said, I don't love your sister any more or less than you, but your sister requires more of my time and attention. And so growing up in that type of environment, and plus my mom, she wanted to be a teacher, but never got the chance. So she ran an in-home daycare. And so there were always kids. And some days you wake up, there are 15, 20 kids running around the house because my mom just kept everybody in the neighborhood. But that was just the environment I grew up in. And, you know, she taught us the sense of community, the sense of supporting each other, treating everybody fairly, making sure everybody had what they need. And so growing up in that environment, yeah, I learned those lessons. So when I became a teacher, the concept of equity was just second nature. It was part of who I am, where I was raised due to my mother. And so for most of my life, she only had a sixth grade education, but she was the best teacher I ever had.
Equality versus equity. I think that's what you learned from your mom. Help us teachers understand that, the difference.
Equality is giving everyone the same thing. You know, no matter where you come from, no matter what you do, everyone gets the same thing. Equity says, this kid may need more, another kid may need less, but my job is to give them what they need. And there's no plan for equity. And that's one of the biggest frustrations I have in education. When someone says, oh, I have this great platform that's going to increase equity, equity isn't about a plan. Equity is seeing that someone needs something and getting it for them, getting it done. That, you know, money be damned, everything out the window. If you need this, it is my job as an educator to get it for you. And that's what true equity is. And so you don't weigh the cost, you don't weigh the political aspirations. You just do what needs to be done for that kid in front of you to be successful. That's what true equity is.
So connect some dots for me, because when I heard you on that podcast a couple of years ago, the thing that that really resonated with me, right, is this continual push that you have to move away from exclusionary practices.
Yeah.
Not just because they're awful, but because they're awful also 10 times more for our Black and Brown kids, right? For marginalized children.
Yes.
So what's the connection, right? How do we connect A and B, this theme of equity, to the exclusionary practices and to think differently about what we do and why we're doing it?
I tell people, also, what's your job? Your job is an educator. Your job is to teach. People come to you wanting to learn, whether that be academic, whether that be social. Your job as a teacher is to teach them. When I tell you, you can't come here, I fail. I am not a teacher, because I've now put you out of the business of learning. And so that's why I never believed in this. I can't say ever believe, because as like all good people, you evolve over time. But I don't believe in exclusionary discipline. I believe in restorative practices. I believe in helping students learn from their behavior, helping students correct and modify their behavior. And I believe in giving students a chance to grow. I tell people all the time, kids are supposed to do dumb stuff. That's just the nature of being kids. Kids do dumb stuff all the time. Our job as adults is to teach them right from wrong, moral from immoral, and to make better decisions. And when you say you can't be here anymore because of a decision you made, you now are not doing your job as an educator, which is to teach. My job is to teach you better behavior. My job is to teach you how to make better decisions, to teach you problem solving, to teach you conflict resolution, to teach you the things that you're clearly lacking. You know, that is my job as an educator. And I think it's so lazy. Suspensions are lazy. Suspensions are an easy, quick fix. Get out of school. We don't want you to deal with it. But the reality is, you never helped anyone deal with the issue. You know, I tell people all the time, okay, so two kids get into an altercation, you suspend them, they sit at home for 5 days, they come back. What happened? You did nothing to resolve the conflict. You know, as a matter of fact, you put them in the streets, or now they're on social media. They may be in the streets. The situation may be growing. So when they see each other again in the building, it may grow even more. So our job as educators should be, okay, you made a mistake. You did something wrong. Let's talk about what you did wrong. Why is it wrong? Help you understand why it's wrong and deal with correcting those actions, restoring the harm that you caused through your behavior. And that's what true restorative practices are. And the reality is, a lot of an education, restorative practices has become a buzzword. It really has become a buzzword. Oh, I'm doing restorative practices. But the second something goes wrong or a parent is upset, we're back to these exclusionary policies, these iron-fisted disciplinary. Restorative practices is hard. It's not an easy fix. It's hard. It requires 100% buy-in from staff, students, and teachers and community in order to work. And if no one's willing to buy in, to not get upset when something happens or things get a little out of control, then it's not going to work. I see it all the time in communities. We're going to do restorative practices. The second an incident happens, okay, now we're adding more metal detectors. We're adding more police officers to the school. What? That's not restored. You know, what you're doing is you're bringing in tools of violence to create a nonviolent environment. Because that's really all you're doing. Police officers or school resource officers, as the term is, they're really just police officers. They're just equipped with tools of violence. They only know to come in and use force to stop whatever's going on. They aren't using de-escalation techniques. They aren't using restorative practices. They aren't using conflict resolution. They just come in with a heavy-handed fist to stop the actions, punish those involved, and no one learns a thing. Restorative practices requires 100% commitment for everyone in the school. If one person's not committed, it's not going to work. And so everyone has to be committed. Everyone needs to be professionally developed on what restorative practices is. I remember in my district alone, I was at a school and there was a principal who was like, we're doing restorative practices. And the teacher saw restorative practices as one thing, the principal saw it as another thing, and it was just mass confusion. And anytime there's mass confusion, kids are going to take advantage of it. Everybody needs to get on the same page, define what it is, go through the process, and everyone adhere to the plan, because exclusionary discipline only puts our kids at harm's risk. You're putting them back in a situation where they learn the negative behaviors to start with.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you brought up the buzzword, I think you said, because that's just the reality. And I strongly agree, right? Like at the end of the day, there's so many people that are using these buzzwords, but it's still highly compliant based. There's been no true shift of the conceptualization. It's they don't really understand the why behind it.
Yeah. And the whole idea of SROs is, no, we don't need police officers in school, especially when it comes to Black and brown students. They don't have great relationships with police officers. And it also, I would go as far as to say, having police officers increases the anxiety amongst your Black and brown students in the school. So they don't feel safe. And so we need to stop with this. We need a police officer in every school. We need armed security. How many times have you seen a gun calm an environment? Think about that. You know, if there's a situation and someone's like, ooh, the person with the gun, they have the solution. No. They don't have the solution. They're only going to cause more issues. So it's really just, let's remove the weapons. Let's remove police officers. Let's remove all tools of violence from the school and teach our kids how to handle conflict, how to talk through things, how to work things out amongst each other. Now, is that going to work? Is that going to be 100% successful plan all the time? No. But you're going to have some success. You're going to have students who buy in. You're going to have students who view that as a safer alternative than escalating the violence in the school.
I gotta ask, where did you learn how to deal with student behavior? Because I think one of the things that we hear sometimes is, I didn't get training as a teacher to deal with behavior. I got training as a teacher to teach the curriculum.
I think that's a lazy mindset when it comes to discipline. You know, as an educator, one of the things I've always said is I'm gonna seek out the answers. What do my kids need? I'm going to seek it out. And I realized, because I was a compliance teacher when I first started. Hey, I need everybody to do this. I need everybody to fall in line. And if you don't fall in line, this is the punishment. But then I realized I'm not being successful that way. Yes, I'm being somewhat successful, but I'm still leaving a lot of kids out, you know, because some kids don't have the ability to comply. If I'm a kid with oppositional defiance disorder and I go into a class where a teacher is asking, comply, 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 well, I've already been clinically diagnosed that's not how I operate. So I'm automatically not going to reach that kid. So I just learned on how to build relationships. I learned a lot from my exceptional education colleagues. If a kid is defined with oppositional defiance disorder, I'd run to them. What is this? What are the triggers? How do I deal with it? Having those conversations, because I want to learn what's best for the kids. And it goes back to that, hey, what does this kid need? Okay, this kid has oppositional defiance disorder. Okay, I'm not going to give them a lot of directives. You know, I'm going to learn other ways to deal with them. The reality is teachers need to have more conversations with each other. You may not be an expert on it, but that teacher down the hall, they are an expert on it. You know, and have those conversations, build those relationships, work with communities, work with families. One of my big things was I would work with the behavioral agencies and start talking to them about what are some of the trends you're seeing coming with the kids nowadays. And we'd have conversations about what's going on, you know, in the neighborhoods, what's going on with the students, and start having conversations. Well, how do you deal with it at your agency? You know, this is not formal professional development. This is just me as a teacher seeking knowledge. I think the biggest resource we have with a lot of kids are parents. You know, I know certain people have weaponized parents lately as, you know, political assets, but really parents are the kids' best educator. They're the first and best teacher. And so having conversations of, hey, well, how did your kid learn? You know, what are the triggers of your kid? What are the things I, as a teacher, I should never do or say to your kid, you know, having those conversations. And it's really just come from my dad and being a personable guy and just talking to people and getting to know people and welcoming everyone into my classroom, into my neighborhood, and having those conversations. So when those behaviors and things jump off, I've been equipped because I have the knowledge. You know, and like I said, there's not a lot of formal training. Now, I will admit, I started working in 2015 in the juvenile detention center. We did get a lot of training that I felt, okay, this would have been helpful if I was in the classroom. And so I've been advocating for the trainings that we got working in the detention center to go to the schools and actually work with school. And they've implemented some of those. Some of the trainings we got, such as gang training, identifying kids in the crisis, those sorts of things have really helped me as an educator, but also taking those to other teachers. I remember one time we were at a school in our district. I would say this is the most affluent school in our neighborhood. It was a elementary school. And I'm there for an event and I'm walking down the hall and I like, hey, you guys got a gang issue here. You know, and I remember immediately everyone pushed back on me. We don't have gang issues here. We're the best school in the district. We don't have that sort of issue. And I'm like, I'm looking at some of the graffiti and all in the building. This is gang stuff. And lo and behold, having that conversation with the principal, he noticed a small pocket of kids that were getting into some of that thing. But then now his teachers are trained. And then we started training other teachers on how to pick up those little signs in elementary school that before they get to middle school could grow into bigger issues and putting those supports in place. So there is formal training out there, but one thing I often say is teachers are so overburdened right now, so overburdened. We really have to be careful what we're asking them to do because one more thing on the plate might be the thing that causes the table to crash. So we really have to be mindful of that. And we're walking a delicate balance right now. But I often say, I would much rather you teach a child than a curriculum. I would much rather you get training on social emotional learning, on how to identify kids in crisis or how to identify things that kids are going through. That curriculum stuff, you're an adult. You know more than children. You'll be able to figure out and teach them. I would rather you focus on what does it take to improve the child, and the curriculum will come later.
Can we expand a little bit on the juvenile center where you taught? I think it was Virgie Binford. I could be wrong.
Yes.
A couple things I'm really curious is how staff supported each other. That's number one. If you can talk about that, because I'm sure you had that chemistry going on. And my second question is, what did you learn from those kids?
Good question. But I think one thing, just to give you a history of Virgie Benford was shut down in 2011 due to numerous violations of civil rights. And when we were brought in 2015, my principal, Tanisha Ford, who's not only a principal, but one of my best friends in life, she had the idea, I'm going to bring in solid people from the community who know the kids, who know their parents, their everyone. And we're going to focus on what these kids need to be successful. And so by going in, and I remember my first day there, one of the most disheartening things that was said to me was by the superintendent of the jail. He said, education is third. Safety is number one. Civil rights is number two. And just keep them quiet and don't let them fight. And I was like, I'm an educator. I'm going to teach. And everybody on the team, like, we're educators. We're going to teach. And so by teaching, having these conversations about what kids need, listening to the kids and, you know, getting them to understand how to advocate for what you need the right way. And eventually, as we began to do things like that, lo and behold, the jail side of jail staff noticed, hey, the school is better. The kids are doing better. But also violence is down in our facility. You know, we're not dealing with as many issues. The kids are having discussions about what they need, what they want. And so it was just one of those things where they realized, wait a minute, a solid education, a solid school where kids believe in themselves, we don't have as much violence. And so they gave us the freedom to do a lot more because it was working. You know, and I remember one incident, you know, one of the kids, he was really having a bad day and he was just cutting up and causing all kinds of problems. And I remember like all the guards called each other around, and I was really upset because I've seen this before. You know, they had real weapons free facility, but they do use some restraint techniques on kids and things like of that nature. And so when all those guards came around, I left because I knew what was going to happen, and that's the part of the job I hated the most. And then all of a sudden, I noticed all the guards are coming out one by one, and then the supervisor comes out. He looks at me, he's like, "Y'all making us real therapeutic around here." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And he's like, "That kid was upset over something that happened on the other shift with the other guards. And so they sat there, the kid said what happened, they listened to the kid, and they overruled the punishment because the kid was right." And he said, that's why he's like, "Y'all making us therapeutic around here," because they listened to the kid. But that's what it's all about. It's about listening to kids. And even when the things you talk about, what we learned from the kids, one thing we would always do whenever I brought in the mayor, I brought in state senators, I brought in even the governor at one point to talk to the kids. But no, you don't talk to the kids, you listen to the kids. You come in for an hour with the kids, for 45 minutes, you're not allowed to say a word. You have to listen to every kid, what they say. And then when they're finished, then you can take note, you can speak back, you can talk to them, you can ask questions. And that did so much, not only for the kids' self-esteem, but I felt the lawmakers got a lot out of it because they understood some of the issues that our kids were facing. Something small, I remember one of my kids told the mayor, "We get in trouble because we don't have anything to do." You know, once you're 13 in the city of Richmond, you're out of parks and recreation, you're pretty much on the street. Unless you got enough grades to play a sport in high school, there's nothing for you to do. And so I remember the next year in the budget, the mayor kicked in a couple extra million to expand parks and recreation to include teens. I remember state senator one time, she came in and she talked to the kids, and the kids like, "We hate the judges." And they went in for like an hour straight talking about some of the judges of their cases and the things they were going through. And two judges ended up getting fired because the state senators, they're the ones who appoint judges. And so she went back and had her staff review some of the case files and understand, and two of the judges got fired. You know, and that was just really empowering for the kids. But I think the politicians got more out of it because they understood, hey, these aren't bad kids. These are kids of circumstance. And we as a society have failed them. If we come in and listen to them, provide them the resources they need, and put in supports that can help them overcome their situations, then these kids can go on and be very successful. And they had test cases from our jail of kids who gone on and become very successful based on supports that were put in place.
I'm just curious, you might not have this data, but did you notice, just kind of off the top of your head, was there any correlation between those groups of kids that you worked at that juvenile center and exclusionary practices that they had prior to getting there?
Oh yeah, I would say 75% of my kids said their first interaction with law enforcement was in schools. I actually interviewed them and actually took the stats on that. 75% of them said their first charge came from school, whether it was disorderly conduct or misdemeanor assault charge or something of that nature. It started at school. And one of the things that came out of that was State Senator Jennifer McClellan and Representative Jeff Bourne. Of course, Jennifer McClellan, she's in the House of Rep, U.S. Congress now doing wonderful things. They introduced the bill but lessened suspension policies in schools, eliminated long-term suspensions for the majority of students. Not only that, but they limited what disorderly conduct was in school. They removed the power to charge out of the hands of the police officers of the school and put it back in the hands of the principal. You know, those little things make a big difference as far as helping kids make their way through the legal system. Because if I go to court for a charge, but then I look and I have two disorderly conducts and two assault charges from a school fight, then that adds up. It's all based on a point system in Virginia when they go to court. Those are more points on my system, which would increase my punishment.
All right, I want to go back to the end of Steve's question there for a second of what you learn from the kids. Because right now you're in a position that you're essentially teaching the teachers, right? You're the developing the skill set of the teachers. So how are you learning the lessons and the stories that
that were given to you by those students to develop teachers now?
I tell teachers the most important job you have is discipline. And the reason I say that is because you have the best relationship of the kid of anyone they will encounter in the entire school process. And when you as a teacher fail to help students, you're turning them over. Each time you're turning them over to a person who don't know the student, who don't know the situation. You know, if I'm a teacher and I write a referral and I send it to the principal, that principal isn't just responsible for but that's the reality of school situation right now. As a teacher, I got 30 kids in my class. And so I'm responsible for them. I turn that over to the principal, who's now in charge of 1,000 plus kids. So he doesn't know that kid as well as you do. He doesn't know the situation in it. The principal turns it over to law enforcement. Now law enforcement has no idea of what this kid is going through or what the full situation is. So what you're doing is you're turning them over to a system that systemically shows they do not care about Black and brown people, especially boys in the situation and young girls. And so your job as a teacher is to create an environment where behaviors are minimized and where you provide solutions. I tell people all the time, one of the proudest things I do in my last 5 years of comprehensive high school, I wrote two referrals. Two referrals. And that's because of mandatory reporting situations. I live by the concept, I can handle this better than the principal because I know the kids, I know the situation. A phone call home can handle this. Or a phone call to Big Brother, who I taught a couple of years ago. You know, just having that relationship. And one of the issues, I think, in education, you know, is we become a very mobile society. The idea of someone growing and staying and working in a community multiple years has pretty much gone away. But the advantage of working in a community for years, like I always had this game. Remember that game was the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon? Where you try to get to know Kevin Bacon. I would always play that with my students, especially when they came to the jail. Within 6 questions of talking to you, we're going to have a mutual connection. Starts with where are you from? What neighborhood are you from? When you tell me what neighborhood you're from, okay, I know the director of the Boys and Girls Club in that neighborhood. You know, or I know the director at the housing complex that you live in, or I know one of the community workers in that area. And just by going through that, who are your people? And when they start telling me who their family members are, then I can maybe make that connection. And within 6 questions, I'm going to find a connection that you and I have, someone that we mutually know and that we can build, because that's where it all starts, having that connection and building and letting them know. I always tell people, check my street cred. I've been around here. You know, I'm from the neighborhood. I know your people. We can have this conversation. And that really, really is an important thing. I think it's lost, and that's just society. We become far mobile. Most people don't stay in areas too long. And I'll be honest, in the city of Richmond, a lot of it is a housing issue. Teachers can't afford to live in the city of Richmond anymore. Teachers are living 2 to 3 counties over because that's where they can afford to live. So many teachers would love to live in the city, live in their neighborhoods, but with the salary they get and the skyrocketing real estate market, they can't afford to live in their city. So there are a number of factors that make it impossible to do that. But it's really about building relationships, not just with the students, but with the community.
I was really struck by something I believe with you 100%, that you and the people you train and the people you influence see the intrinsic value, the intrinsic love inside of every child. I believe it was in one of your talks, you said, you know, you just got to love them.
Yeah.
You just got to love them. And that always sounds really good. And I believe it. And I know, Jessica, we believe it. But how do you do it?
The real tool to dealing with that is a mirror. You have to look in the mirror. You have to ask yourself hard questions and be uncomfortable with the answers, but be uncomfortable enough to where you want to change. I think a lot of times teachers have preconceived notions. Teachers have implicit biases that they need to address within themselves before they can love on a child. I tell the people all the time, well, actually, this comes from one of our superintendents. Well, our superintendent, what he says is, if you can't see that child as your own with the same expectations and love for that child, then you don't deserve the pleasure of teaching. You should look at that kid. You should see yourself. And one of the things we're focused on right now in my department is who in the community wants to teach and providing ways for those folks to become teachers. That's where it starts. You got to have folks that are invested in the school, invested in the community, that want to teach. One of the things we have right now in our district is a program called Build Our Own Teacher. What that is, we're going to take instructional assistants, long-term subs, neighborhood coaches, people that have been working in the community for years with kids in various non-classroom or non-teaching roles, and we're going to help you get your teaching license. We're going to pay for your classes necessary for you to get your teaching certification. We're going to pay for your tests. We're going to get you tutoring for the test so that you can get your teaching license because you've already shown a commitment to our kids. We don't have to worry about cultural biases and those things because you work with the kids for years. You are the neighborhood. You grew up in the neighborhood. We want to help you become teachers. One of my long-term goals is by next year to have a program in place where any kid in the city of Richmond who wants to teach, we're going to make it completely free for you to get a college education to teach, whether that's through community college, whether that's through registered apprentice programs. We're going to make it easy for you to teach. Plus, we're going to employ you the entire time as instructional assistants, as registered apprentices. Growing up, one of my favorite games is baseball. You know, my uncles that love baseball, and they would always talk about baseball. We're going to look at like the minor leagues. You know, single A ball is when you're in high school, you're doing Ed Rising and those things. Double A balls is when you're working as an instructional assistant your first 2 years of college. Triple A ball is when you're a registered apprentice your third and fourth year out of school, and then you hit the majors and you'll be teaching in your first year. And so we're looking at a long-term program that takes people from the community, provides them a living wage, and pays for their education to become teachers.
I love that. I absolutely love that. I know Steve's giving a round of applause. It's so beautiful because, you know, Rodney, you started the whole conversation today talking about the reality that our students come into the classroom at different levels, yeah. Right? And at the same time, you're now creating a program for teachers that acknowledges the exact same reality, that our teachers come into the profession with different levels. And frankly, you know, we're really biased on what levels we accept and who those people are.
Yep.
So you're doing the same thing, but now for the adults in a way that in theory then would begin to change the stories for the kids as well.
Yeah. And when you have that much practice with students, as you grow, you're naturally going to be a good teacher by the time you start teaching because you understand the relationships, the pedagogy, those sorts of things throughout the years and how important it is. And more importantly, because you're vested in the neighborhood, you're not just a college graduate who moved into their town and decided to get a job teaching. You're a person who grew up in the neighborhood. You are vested in the community, in the city. You want everybody to be successful. And you have those relationships.
This all sounds like the definition of cultural equity.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I often said, you know, when I was national teacher, one thing Johanna Hayes taught me, you're never a former national teacher of the year. You're always a year, then the national teaching year. So one of my platforms is cultural equity. I want to make sure every kid has a teacher or an educator in front of them who looks like them or understands them, understands their community, understands their hopes, dreams, and aspirations, and pushes them to be the best that they can be, regardless of their circumstance. You know, it's no secret we need more teachers of color in the classroom. We're dealing with half the students in the United States are students of color when teaching is still an 80% white profession. We need to balance that out a little bit. You know, we really need to understand that, hey, I could talk research all day of why it's better for students of color and teachers of color, but I lived. I would not be where I am today without those teachers of color who pushed me to be the best I can be. And I'm not saying that my white teachers were bad, although quite a few were. I had some great white teachers along the way. I can talk about Ms. McKeever, my seventh grade teacher. who fought to get me in the gifted and talented program when they wanted to keep me out because of racial reasons. Dr. Dirk Phillipson, one of my best college professors at Virginia State University, a white professor at HBCU who pushed me to be my best. Just because I say we need more educators of color, that doesn't necessarily mean white teachers can't teach children of color. No, the world is better when there's a diverse class of folks working with everyone. How are we preparing our kids, Black and white, for a 21st century world when everyone they see in front of their classroom is white? Think about the subliminal messages we're sending to not only the Black kids of what you can't do, but sending the white kids of what you can do. The air of superiority, the ability to understand that, hey, wait a minute, all teachers are white, so therefore Black people aren't smart. Those are the types of messages we're sending to kids when we don't have a diverse teacher workforce. And not just K through 12, it gets worse when we talk about the colleges. You know, now that number jumps from 80% to 86% white when we talk about who's running our schools of education. So we really need to make a commitment to get more educators of color. I think Secretary Cardona is doing the best he can in this highly politicized world to emphasize the need of more teachers of color. I think there's so many programs like the 1 Million Teachers of Color program through the Hunt Institute, Center for Black Educator Excellence. Even in Richmond, we have a program called RVA Men Teach, where we're supporting male minority teachers to get more of them in the classroom. And because we understand our students perform better when they have people who look like them in front of the classroom. So our number one job as educators, if we truly want to tackle the quote unquote achievement gap, I'm not even going to go into what I think about that word, but if we truly want to tackle that, then we need more teachers of color in the classroom.
Amen. I'm not going to take the bait either because we've kept you so long, but I could have a whole entire episode on that damn word, the achievement gap.
Yeah, that's why I said quote unquote. If you can't see on the podcast, but there are air quotes
they around the word. They can't see your beautiful air quotes. They can't.
Yes.
Yeah. Rainer, we got to let this fine man go. What do you want to say?
Oh, I just want to make one last comment. As a white student, I wish I had had more teachers of color as well. My life would have been richer for it. That wasn't the reality for me, but I would love it to be the reality for my grandchildren.
Yes. And it's funny because I think Casey Bethel, a friend of mine, principal in Georgia, he often says he can guarantee you Derek Chauvin, the guy who killed George Floyd, never had a Black teacher in his life. Because there's no way you could not see the humanity in someone if you ever had positive encounters with people of their culture. It's not just the benefit of Black and brown students. It benefits all students. I said, everybody benefits from diversity. Diversity has never hurt anyone.
Amen. Well, I hate wrapping this up, but we have to let you go because, again, you do everything for everybody.
That's all good. I appreciate the opportunity.
It was such an honor having you join us, Rodney, and your passion, right? The way you are changing the world, it's infectious. And I feel like I'm on cloud 9 right now. So thank you for that. And it is so blatantly clear, you know, how you became the teacher of the year. And thank you. Thank you for all that you do. And yeah, honestly, such an honor to have you give us your time.
Thank you for the opportunity. I always love to sit down and just talk education sometimes with folks. Sometimes we get caught up in this world where we're all doing the job. We don't get a chance to just sit down and talk about things from a non-strategic way of focusing on the school. No, what are the real issues in education? Is let's have conversations on how we as a society, because it's not just teachers, it's not just educators, it's not just parents. Everybody has a stake in education. I say our national teacher shortage is a national security issue. It really is at this point. If we want the future engineers, doctors, and lawyers, we need to have folks to train those engineers, doctors, and lawyers. So we really need to uplift this profession and uplift those who want to stay. And quite honestly, and I'll say this, get rid of those who don't want to be here, because nothing is worse than a kid having someone who doesn't want to be here.
Yeah. Look, and I know I have to let you go, but I feel like sometimes we're doing the opposite, right? We're retaining the ones that, and again, there are so many teachers that listen to this podcast that are phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
Right. And at the same time, I do think sometimes we retain the ones that technically don't have anywhere else to go. And they're just kind of sitting here, and we lose the ones that we should be keeping. So
I'll say something that I said when you talk about Bettina Love on her podcast is like, send me someone with bad pedagogy and we can fix that. Send me someone who doesn't believe in kids and love kids. There's not a darn thing we can do. Let's get rid of them.
He was going to say damned everyone, just for those that were listening. So
I don't know how your audience feels about that.
That sentence, it fit perfectly. So we're going to let that slide.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Thank you. It's been an honor, and man, you are doing the good work.
Thank you.